This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and it is with a heavy heart today that I announce the passing of our longtime host, Doug Hamilton, following his battle with cancer. He was a longtime TV anchor. He worked in higher education. He was active in the theater, and he returned to his journalism roots to host Main Street. We will be reaching out to some of his many friends to put together a tribute show for next week. But if I could, I'd like to start with my own. Doug Hamilton and I started on Main Street on the same day, and I was all of 30 years old, maybe. And I walked into the room, and it was kind of one of those, what the hell am I doing in this room? This is Doug Hamilton. This is Doug Hamilton. And I wanted right away to let him know how eager I was to be able to learn from him and to work alongside of him. I knew he was an actor. I knew he was a longtime journalism professional. And so I asked his opinion on my voice. I was so self-conscious about it. And I said, what should I do to, you know, sound better on the radio? And he just looked at me and he said, why don't you try sounding like yourself? And I never had to prove to him that I deserved to be here. From the very first moment, he was teaching me to trust myself. If you have a comment you'd like to share about Doug, you can find a post on the Prairie Public page on Facebook. You can also send an email to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we are going to talk now about what it means to be a warrior, and is it the same thing as being a fighter? We're visiting with DJ Vanis. He is an enrolled member of the Ottawa Tribe of Michigan and a former U.S. Air Force officer. He is the author of the new book, The Warrior Within, Own Your Power to Serve, Fight, Protect, and Heal. DJ, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
I am struck immediately on reading the book that you have a blurb from General Stanley McChrystal, retired U.S. Army, very high up there, general. And then you also have a blurb from Leanne Tiemann, the author of Chicken Soup for the Soul and founder of Self-Care for Healthcare. And so right away, I think we need to set up this idea that to be a warrior has much more to do than this, you know, sort of just this soldier, just this fighter approach. And you bring in these other elements of things like self-care. What is the difference between a warrior and a fighter?
Great question. A fighter uses their talent, ability, energy, and time to achieve a goal that primarily benefits themselves. And that's important. We have to be a fighter before we become a warrior. And a fighter is the one who accomplishes a goal to leave a bad relationship or go back to school or lose weight. We need that. That's an important aspect of any arena of self-development. But becoming a warrior means that you're using those same abilities, talents, and resources and to impact somebody else's life. So that warrior role, you know, stereotypically in that Hollywood image is one that we all see on the big screen. You know, the sweaty, chiseled figure that's knocking down buildings and bad guys with bazookas and occasional surly looks at the camera, you know.
And is almost always male.
Exactly. Almost always male, doesn't need anybody, you know, and does it all in the name of glory. And I approach that warrior role from a tribal centric viewpoint from our tribal traditions. And that role was all about service. It was somebody who made a commitment to use their creator given talent and ability to become an asset or a benefit to the tribe that they served. It was somebody who fought for something bigger than their own personal welfare, somebody who led by example, somebody who asked a question, not what could I get, but what could I do for someone else? And who ultimately at the end of the day had dedicated their lives to serving others well. And so that transcends race. It transcends age, gender, stage of life. It's a path available for anybody willing to walk it.
And you are an enrolled member of the Ottawa Tribe of Michigan and also a former U.S. Air Force officer. Do you feel like those are two mutually exclusive approaches to being a warrior? Or is there room?
No, there's actually a lot of overlap. That's a great question. The military has a great service concept. I wore a uniform for 14 years, and I was also a military brat, so my dad was in for 21. And the military offers a great service concept, but the one that I like that I fell in love with and really connected with me at a spirit level was the one from our tribal communities, because that role was it was a lot more accessible. It made sense as far as being driven by love, being driven by a compelling, drive to make the world a better place, if you want to look at it that way. And so that's why it's also, the one that I share in the book, because it is available for anybody willing to walk it. It goes beyond wearing a uniform or combat boots. This is something that speaks to the heart of who we are as human beings and is accessible for anyone willing to walk it.
You talk very early in the book about going through the ceremony of the sun dance. Please take a moment to just explain what that is. And then the real question here is, how did that work on this sort of transformative level that's kind of hard to put your finger on exactly why it's working, I guess?
Yeah, the Sundance was a transformative experience for me. It was, Sundance is a timeless ceremony, and it's done for Thanksgiving. It's to give thanks for all the things that we take for granted in life, our food, water, shelter, friends, family, and we go without those things during the ceremony. We also dance from sunup to sundown each day to give, to pray for everyone and everything in the world except for ourselves. So it's a ceremony of sacrifice, a ceremony of Thanksgiving. And it's transformative in the fact that it was extremely hard. It was a grueling ceremony. But when I was completed, when the ceremony was completed, my medicine man came up to me, CeeLo Black Crow, and he said, "Remember, you're a warrior now." And I felt about an inch tall. It was a ultimate exercise in humility, because everything I learned in that circle about that traditional warrior role was different than what I had saw growing up on TV or in media. And so that's why that ceremony, meant so much to me, because it put me on the path that I'm on now, even to write the book that I, just released a couple of days ago, The Warrior Within.
Yeah, it seems very much to have a heavy component of protection.
It does. I mean, that's the Hollywood image is all about aggression, dominance, stepping on somebody to get ahead in that role. But in our traditional ways, a warrior was a peacekeeper as well, a protector, a defender, somebody who had love as one of the primary fuel sources of what they did. They loved who they were defending and protecting. And when we love what we're fighting for, it elevates our ability in that battle and pushes us to levels we didn't know we could achieve, and be able to navigate problems we didn't know we could get through.
We're visiting today with DJ Vanas, the author of The Warrior Within, Own Your Power to Serve, Fight, Protect, and Heal. He is a member of the Ottawa Tribe of Michigan and a former U.S. Air Force officer. And DJ, a moment ago, you talked about the medicine man who played such an important role in your Sundance ceremony. And in the book, you talk about the best resources for a warrior: sleep, time, and a personal medicine bag. Am I correct in assuming here that medicine and medication don't mean the same thing?
You are correct. I'm glad that you're bringing that up. To clarify that, when I say the word medicine, in general society, we think very quickly of a pill or a vaccine. You know, we think about that a lot. Mm-hmm. We see it everywhere. But medicine in our, you know, traditional circles is very different. You know, my people call medicine mushkeke, which means strength that you gather from the earth. Mm-hmm. And anything and everything can qualify as long as it keeps us strong mind, body, and spirit. It could be time with our friends. It could be watching funny movies, pursuing a hobby, getting enough sleep. But all those things matter because they strengthen us to do and fulfill the role that we have put ourselves on, or to, you know, fulfill the role that we're choosing to fulfill. We can't do that if we are burned out or apathetic. You know, I say in the book, you can't be a warrior if you're falling apart. It just doesn't work. It's a complete disconnect.
You just said a role that we are choosing to fulfill. And if you could tie that into the concept in the book that you talk about too, that being a warrior is a mindset. Can you be a warrior if someone just says, hey, it's your job to do this, so do it? Or does it have to come from within?
To be most effective, it has to come from within. This is something we are called to do. This is something we choose to do. And when we do that, we're bringing all our capacity, all of our capability in that moment. When somebody else is telling us what we need to do, that is it's a halfway type of effort. You know, we're only going to ever be so good in that role. And that's what I talk about in the book, is choosing the meaning that our work has for us. When our boss is telling us what that is, when, you know, the mission statement for the company is telling us what that is, there's only going to be a certain level of commitment we ever get to in fulfilling it. But when we give our work meaning and we define what that meaning is, now we're cooking with gas. Now we're really unleashing our capability because our commitment is high and we're all in. And that's when our best stuff comes out.
Right away, you dedicate the book, and again, it's called The Warrior Within. You dedicate the book to the Creator who continues to guide and strengthen me, and to my luminescent, effervescent daughters, Gabrielle and Isabella. And I just love this idea, as you are talking about, to be a warrior means that you have this meaning, and talking about walking these two different paths as a being that has been created, but also, you know, a creator yourself in that you've brought other life into this world. Can you talk about the approach of being a warrior from those two standpoints?
Well, ultimately, you know, that warrior role goes back to service. And the reason why is because it's our highest calling, you know, is to be able to, you know, if we're not put here to serve, why are we here at all? And closely related to that is creation. You know, we're a chip off the old block. We come from a creator. We are creators ourselves. And that's what makes us uniquely and powerfully us in this world. And when we're able to do that, it's the most fulfilling endeavor we pursue, is to be able to leave this world a better place than we found it. And we do that by serving other people well, creating new things or recreating things to be better as we go through our journey. But that's really, you know, the core component. That service, you know, is the beating heart of that warrior role. It's our high, you know, service is our highest calling. It's our deepest need. Mm. You know, we all have a need to feel valued at some level. And we get that need fulfilled when we serve somebody else well, which is great. That's like the ultimate game of connect the dots, you know. And then the third reason why service is so critically important in this warrior role is because it's our legacy. It's what we leave behind us when we're gone. And when we draw our last breath, how we'll be remembered is through those moments of service to other human beings where we had an impact in their life, hopefully in a very positive, meaningful way. That outlives us in the end.
Do you remember your first time you felt or that you recognized a call to serve?
Oh, I'd have to really dig out the archives mentally on that one. You know, it's been a component my whole life, and I watched it growing up because I come from two service providers. And when my dad was career military, my mom was a career nurse. So I can't remember the earliest moment where I wanted to be of service, but I always knew that I wanted to be. That was just kind of a theme throughout my life. It's where I'm most fulfilled. It's where I'm most passionate. And it's what I love to do, you know, is help other people to do that better in their own lives too. You know, I've always looked at my work as providing for the providers, you know, the people who are out in the front lines doing good works in the world. I've always looked at my role as strengthening them, you know, getting them to increase their resilience and have more clarity in their path and be able to take care of themselves in a better way so that they can sustain that, you know, be in the good fight day in and day out, not just be strong this week, but for a lifetime, for a career.
You call in the book the greatest threat to service apathy. Mm-hmm. This
yes.
not caring at all. And you just use the phrase, you know, providing for the providers. Take us to a moment, DJ, though, where it was hard for you to find the will to go on.
Oh, wow. Well, I've learned how not to do it. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about doing it right is I started off, you know, when I was still an active duty officer, I had a lot of responsibility. We had just started a family and I had just started a business. And I was running in a million different directions with my hair on fire. I wanted to contribute. I wanted to make a big, you know, a positive impact with those I was serving, but it was killing me in the process. I was going, you know, I was stretched too thin. I felt it and I ended up getting the shingles. And it was one of those conditions I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. It was awful. And it was the resurgence of chicken pox later in life brought on by stress.
Right. Which usually happens much later in life when the immune system is lower.
Exactly. And the doctor I saw was shocked that somebody my age had it and basically said, what are you doing to yourself? And it really got me to kind of come to grips with the idea that intentions can be great, but the execution is what matters. You know, how we deliver the goods day in and day out is either sustainable or just for now. And I'd rather have it be sustainable. And that's why in the book, I kind of step people through how to stay strong and resilient, not just for this week or this month or for this project, but for a lifetime, for a career. Without that, we go into the apathy phase, you know, the burnout. And apathy is truly where we lose the bubble. You know, our internal fire goes out. We've been overwhelmed. We've you know, worked too hard without taking care of ourselves. And we just get to a point where we are emptied out. And at that point, we're not of service to anyone else, and we're not of service even to ourselves.
So is it as simple as take a bath?
It can be. It can be as simple as exercise, pursuing a hobby, getting enough sleep. I mean, in anything and everything can qualify as medicine, as long as it keeps a strong mind, body, and spirit. But, you know, the way that we look at medicine in our tribal communities is that it's something that we incorporate in our lives, not when we're already out of balance and sick, but we incorporate into our lives daily to keep us strong. You know, I say in the book, we can't be a warrior if we're falling apart. So we've got to incorporate this stuff into our lives if we really want to see the best that we can become in a service environment.
There is a silly little joke that is something like, aren't you glad that men invented golf so that they'd have a reason to go outside and talk to one another? And I think about this in the context of self-care, which is kind of easy to just sort of relegate to the feminine domain, to just say, oh, take a bath, light a candle, not realizing that maybe going out and playing baseball or playing golf or what have you is a kind of self-care. But as
right.
someone who has been a U.S. Air Force officer who is still very active with veterans and talking with people, you know, these high achievers at these Fortune 500 companies that you talk with, do any of them ever just sort of, you know, roll their eyes at you?
Sure, because they are doing, they're fulfilling that role that they think they need to, and they'll do it until they have to change. And the reality is that there's a point in time where we have to, because it becomes unsustainable. You know, and we feel it at a gut level. We feel like too little peanut butter on too much toast. You know, because we're going as fast as we can, as hard as we can, until we just start to fall apart and stand back and look at the debris field and say, how the heck did I get here? Well, the tail of the tape is pretty clear. What you're doing is you're working your rear end off. You're drawing from the well over and over again without putting anything back in it. And so that self-care piece is so critical, because I tell people this, it sounds Dr. Seussian, but it's the absolute truth. You are the only you that you will ever have or be. Hmm. Act accordingly. And if you're not taking good care of yourself, you darn sure can't serve anybody else effectively. We are in reaction mode where our stress is jacked up, our anxiety is jacked up. And at a point in time, our physical health starts to take a toll, as well as our relationships, our performance, our focus. So if we're really in this to fulfill this warrior role fully, self-care is a critical element in that mix, because without that, we are going to be much less than 100% of what we're capable of.
We're visiting today with DJ Vanas, the author of The Warrior Within, Own Your Power to Serve, Fight, Protect, and Heal. He is an enrolled member of the Ottawa Tribe of Michigan and a former U.S. Air Force officer. You can find out more about him at nativediscovery.com. DJ, in the book, you talk about the Japanese katana sword and the difference here between hardness and toughness. So explain what the katana sword is, and then how being hard and being tough are different, but both necessary.
Yes. I love this one. The katana was the sidearm of the famous warrior class of the Japanese samurai. And the katana was probably the finest blade ever created by human hands, because it was made from two different types of metal. The first type of metal had hardness, which means it resisted impact. It did not flex. It was, it was built to be stiff under all conditions. Now, if you build an entire sword with that, it becomes brittle, because if it can't flex, it's going to break. And so the second type of metal that the katana has what's called in metallurgy, toughness, which means it could flex. It could absorb impact. And it's critical that we have both in our own lives. You know, hardness is discipline. It's having structure. It's being able to know what work to do and then to do it, yeah, even when we don't feel like it. But toughness is something different. Toughness really is the secret to mental strength and being able to withstand the blows that life is going to throw our way. Toughness means that we're able to sit down when we go through loss, pain, you know, setbacks, we deal with anxiety or stress, that we actually sit down and process those emotions. And I know this is hard for people to do at times, because we don't want to feel our feelings. We'd rather, you know, outwork them, out hustle them. Mm-hmm. And that can lead us to the places that we're talking about, where we hit burnout, we hit apathy, where none of us wants to be. When we're able to sit down and process our emotions, we're able to ask ourselves questions that are really important. Like, number one, you know, are these thoughts useful? Because sometimes we have a tendency to ruminate. You know, we'll go over the same thing. Why did this happen? Why is this happening to me? Why now? You know, we ruminate asking the same questions that don't have good answers or mm-hmm. an answer. And we waste a lot of time and energy doing that. The second question we can ask is, what story am I telling myself about what's going on right now? And sometimes a story is like playing a game of Mad Libs with your kids. You know, where we're just filling in blanks to these stories, and we're creating this yeah. crazy narrative that has little to do with reality. It has everything to do with fear. And so that's the third question. Is the story I'm telling myself really real, or is it just fear showing up into my life? So when you're able to do that, we can sit with whatever we're going through, process those emotions, and then move forward, you know, from that. We don't have to outrun it. We don't have to out hustle it, outwork it. We just look at it face to face, deal with it, and then move on. And we're much better for it, because then we're not carrying the burden of storing all this stuff away, stuffing it down where it comes out later in ways that we, you know, that are negative or toxic.
It's the sentence in your book, being a warrior is not about being the toughest or bravest. It's about mastering your emotions.
That's it. That's it. And the more we do that, the more capable we are, the less heavy we are in this world. Because we're able to, you know, take care of what we need to for ourselves, and then we're able to take care of other people as well.
DJ Vanas, the author of The Warrior Within, Own Your Power to Serve, Fight, Protect, and Heal. You can find out more at nativediscovery.com. He's a member of the Ottawa Tribe of Michigan and a former U.S. Air Force officer and a highly sought after motivational speaker. DJ, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been an honor. Chi-mi-gwech, thank you very much.
Still to come on Main Street, a North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor inductee, Dave Dauphiné. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Law enforcement officers took a man into custody Thursday afternoon in Jamestown after a standoff that lasted more than 5 hours. Police were called to the scene at around 10 a.m. to 119th 5th Street Northwest in Jamestown. Jamestown Police Chief Scott Ettinger says after the first few hours, the suspect started to leave the building with a knife in hand.
Was threatening himself and then tried to flee the scene and realized he was surrounded. Less lethal rounds were used, some impact rounds that drove him back into the house, finally got him to negotiate with us.
2 hours later, Ettinger says the man was taken into custody.
We introduced some OC into the apartment, and he came out and surrendered.
CS gas is pepper spray. The man was taken by ambulance from the scene. The investigation continues. The director of North Dakota's Transmission Authority says he welcomes the investments of one of the power grid operators serving North Dakota has approved for electric transmission. MISO, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, has okayed $10 billion worth of projects designed to bring more power into the grid. John Wieda says North Dakota is a net exporter of electricity, and he told North Dakota's Industrial Commission this is an opportunity for North Dakota's producers. To illustrate that point, Wieda talked about the price per megawatt as measured Thursday morning.
The price at Center North Dakota for a megawatt of electricity was $10.72. By the time you got to Eastern North Dakota, it was $26.90, so over double. By the time you get to Minneapolis, it was double again. By the time you get to Illinois, it was double again. It was higher yet in Illinois and Michigan.
Wieda says the price per megawatt was well over $100 in Illinois and Michigan, but he cautions that it will take years for the final approvals for those projects. And the Missouri River Joint Water Board and the Missouri River Advisory Committee will be hosting a stakeholders meeting on the management, use, and operations of the Missouri River. Ken Royce is program manager for the joint board.
The stakeholders meeting is set up to do an analysis of the strengths of the river, It's a SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats of that river from the perspective of the North Dakota perspective. What we think in North Dakota, the greatest advantages of that river and the challenges in using that river for, the phrase that's always used is beneficial use. How do we put that water to a beneficial use in the state of North Dakota?
The event is scheduled from 11 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday, August 10th in Mandan. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor Committee is made up of representatives from each of the 5 federally recognized tribes of North Dakota, and they select the people to be inducted into the Hall of Honor. One from last year is Dave Dauphiné of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. He was inducted in the category of military veteran.
We see him as a hero here in the Turtle Mountains, but he doesn't feel like he's a hero. When you talk to him, he's just another soldier. He'll tell you the heroes were left in Vietnam, and we had 5 of those here in the Turtle Mountains. So he would tell you those 5 individuals would be heroes to him.
And we didn't know that. I mean, there's a guy, you see him at the mail every day and not knowing that he's a war hero. 3 Bronze Stars and 1 Silver Star.
It really surprised me when I learned what a hero he was. I had never heard his military story. And then in the newspaper one day, there was this article, and I almost thought I was reading about somebody else because here they were talking about what he had done. And people were saying after that article that he really should have gotten the Congressional Medal of Honor.
I think he well deserves that. And I think people should know what it means and not just as a silver star and have no idea what it is. It's not a everyday occurrence that you can get one of them and still be walking away. He kept people from getting hurt and saved lives of several people.
All my boys, I take pride in every man that was under me, my command, as a section chief, made it out alive.
Dave was a leader. And he would watch out for his fellow soldiers, especially the ones that came to Vietnam, the new recruits, so to speak.
See, when I first went over there, it just happened. We had some green troops. Most of us were green. They were scared. But I had lived a different kind of life. I went to boarding schools, so I was on my own, so quite a bit. So I took charge right away because I knew I had to. Otherwise, I'd have been killed or something. So it didn't take me long to make sergeants, a couple of months.
In the last couple of years, I found out a lot about him and, you know, what role he played in the Vietnam War. He was talking with my wife, and he said, you know, I almost went to jail.
Oh, I was arrested for 5 minutes.
Police showed up, and they tried to arrest me, he said, because I was evading the draft.
One morning, I heard a knock on the door, and I looked out, and I seen two suits out there, and I thought they were after Leonard Peltier, because...
He said, when did I get drafted?
They cuffed me up. You're a draft dodger. Well, I ain't no draft dodger, he said.
They said, we've been sending letters to... Well, his mother had kept the letters, but he's working in another state.
She said, damn letters. She said, I tore them all up.
Of course, then things worked out. He went into the military and became a hero, so... That's what I do know.
He didn't want me to go, but I went.
I went over to his home, and he's a very humble man. I asked about his war experience, and very humbly, he started talking a bit about it.
Yeah, we got a mortar and rocket attack one night. That's what they do before they ground attack us. We fought all night. And I woke up in the morning, I don't know how this happened. See, your adrenaline kicks in and you do things spontaneous, I would say. You lose track of time. Like, you do things and you don't remember. In the morning, I was full of blood. Can't remember how that happened. So the next morning, I looked up. And the generals came down and congratulated us and all that. We made it through.
Now, we can never forget these veterans, all of them.
I think he's an example of bravery, respect, trust. All the seven teachings of the Ojibwe you could find in David, because he risked his life. How many of us are called on to risk our lives? Not many. And if we were called on it, would we do what David did? Dave is also a family man. Got a wonderful wife, Marlene. They do things together. They have this family relationship, like this good family unit.
I honor him for his services that he gave to the United States of America and Vietnam in all of his activities and achievements that he accomplished while he was in Vietnam with the Silver Star and the 3 bronze medals. It's not every soldier that gets those honors.
We had some good times, but not too many. So it was a year in hell, but I came made it out without a scratch. That was it.
Welcome home, Dave, and we're glad you're here. Welcome home, brother.
That audio was taken from a video produced by Mokoche Studios in Bismarck. All of the Hall of Honor profiles are posted on Mokoche's Vimeo page. Dave Thompson is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and on Fridays we visit with News Director Dave Thompson, who joins us from our Bismarck studio. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Ashley.
Now, of course, I started Main Street today with my remembrance of the late Doug Hamilton, the longtime host of Main Street, but Dave, you go back a lot farther with him even.
I do. I will tell you the first time I met him. I went to a meeting in Fargo, and Doug Hamilton was representing one of the Fargo television stations, I think Channel 4 at the time. Had a really good talk with him because we were talking about the nation's state government coverage that I had did in a commercial station here, and how I enjoyed Grand Forks and working at KNOX, and how he was really enjoying his stay at Channel 4. And we had a great conversation.
Yeah.
And it was a very difficult meeting because we were talking about how the Red River Valley should approach coverage of the Garrison Diversion Project.
Oh,
so
sure.
that was an interesting meeting, and I was really impressed with how knowledgeable he was about Garrison Diversion.
Yeah, definitely. I just remember so many times he would walk into an interview and he had an incredible depth of knowledge on so many different topics.
Well prepared on just about every subject that I know of.
Yeah. Now, for me, living in the Fargo-Moorhead area, and of course he was on TV in Fargo-Moorhead for a long time. He was in local FM theater. He used to work at MSU Moorhead. So he is just known in every nook and cranny of the Fargo-Moorhead area. Now, you being based in the western part of the state, do you have a sense of, you know, what he means to our listeners who aren't in the FM area?
Well, back in the day when he was working at Channel 4, Channel 4 had a direct connection with KXMB Television Channel 12, so we'd see his reporting from the valley quite often.
Okay.
And he would actually make trips to Bismarck to do some reporting on issues in Bismarck that were of a more statewide manner. So we ran into him a lot.
Okay.
And really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, he will be sorely missed.
Yes,
and
he will.
Again, a reminder to our listeners that next week we will be offering a much longer tribute to Doug Hamilton's legacy. And he passed away following a long battle with cancer. Dave, there is a story on the website today about MDU and splitting up and making a new company here.
That is correct. What MDU had, and it actually grew out of its coal mining business. It's called Knife River.
Okay.
It is kind of a construction materials and a building company. And it started out fairly small, but it really has grown so that it's in a number of states, including states on the West Coast. And now what MDU has decided is that they're going to create a separate company so that it will have its own and management systems and things like that.
Hmm.
It will still be part of the MDU family, but it will be a standalone company within that.
Okay.
And what MDU is going to then is focus its efforts on is what it called its regulated businesses, which had to be natural gas and electricity.
And, you know, for all intents and purposes, will customers notice anything?
Probably not. They won't notice anything. But if you're a shareholder of MDU, when this happens, you're going to get a share of Knife River for every share of MDU stock you have. So it's a boon to the shareholders as well.
Okay. Our intern, Nick, had a story that medical facilities throughout the state having to continue to rely on traveling nurses. This is, of course, coming out of COVID and just the insane amount of staffing concerns that hospitals were facing. And some of these traveling nurses were making $100 an hour.
More.
Not so sustainable.
No. And then as we're coming out of COVID, the hope among hospitals in North Dakota is that they can hire people permanently, But again, they're trying to do that, and mm-hmm. sometimes they just can't find the nurses because they're in sole demand, not only in hospitals but in clinics and in long-term care facilities.
Well, what's this in-state traveling nurse agency thing?
Well, that was a proposal that has been kicked around for a while, but it has not gotten any real traction at the legislature. But they were thinking about having a state-sponsored agency for traveling nurses to have traveling nurses to be available and to be ready to go where they're needed.
So just like if they're needed in Williston from Fargo or?
Yes, that type of thing, yes.
Okay.
And there's been talk about it, but it really hasn't gotten that far.
Okay. And then some of the longer term facilities I know have had to close down because of the enormous staff costs.
Absolutely. And you've had the ones that are known, Wilton. There mm-hmm. was one in Crosby. And Mott, those have all closed. But there are some projects that are still going ahead with long-term care facilities, but staffing could be a problem.
Another story, there was a man who had previously been convicted in a multiple murder, quite a gruesome murder some years ago, found dead in jail.
Right, and we don't know all what happened, but this is Chad Isaac, who was convicted of the murders of the four people at RJR in Mandan, which is a property management company. Well, he was convicted of all four murders.
Mm-hmm.
At trial, there was no motive shown.
Hmm.
And now he's killed himself in prison, so we probably won't know the motive. And there are still some questions to need to be answered that are going to be part of an investigation going on internally and through the Bureau of Criminal Investigation.
Yeah, I would imagine some of those questions sort of center around, what are the warning signs of somebody who's suicidal in prison? And then what are the different access things? I mean, I know oftentimes
Correct.
They're not even allowed to wear belts because
That's
it can
right.
be a threat of hanging oneself.
That is correct. And, who knows what is going on and who knows what this investigation is going to find out?
Southwest Power Pool is upping its planning reserve margin requirement. Tell us about this one.
This is they've got a reserve requirement now of 12%, and that's to help protect rolling blackouts. So they can, if they are running short of power, they can dive into this 12%. Well, under the guidance of North Dakota Public Service Commissioner Randy Crisman, who's the president of a state agency that helps guide the Southwest Power Pool in its decisions. They upped it to 15%. Again, it's more of a hedge against rolling blackouts and making sure that power is available when it's needed.
Yeah.
And, you go back to what happened in Texas and then also look at what happened in April in northwestern North Dakota when power's out because of blizzards. You know the importance of having some reserve power.
Yeah, and I would suspect sort of similar to what we discussed in the MDU story, probably not going to be very noticeable to customers. It's one of those things where when they're doing their jobs, you don't notice it,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Exactly correct.
Yeah. The Bismarck Airport looking at expanding. I bet that's welcome news following 2 years of pandemic.
It was welcome news, and this ties into something that was on the drawing board back as early as 2018, 2019, the airport was planning to do some expansion projects and had started a study. Then COVID hit and the passenger numbers really tanked.
Mm-hmm.
But it's coming back. Unlike Fargo, which is back now to its pre-COVID levels, Bismarck is still down. Why is that? It's because it's a government town and the government and business travel hasn't yet come back. So they're down about 20%.
Yeah.
But they're expecting that to come back. And when it does come back, they want to be prepared for it.
Okay.
So the airport is talking about such things as maybe adding gates, maybe adding some space in the passenger boarding area, maybe even adding another carousel for luggage. Hmm. It depends on what they think is going to happen with traffic.
And how many gates and how many luggage carousels are there?
There are two carousels, four gates. They want to go to at least five and maybe six gates. And it was interesting talking to the airport manager, Greg Haug. I've known him for a long time. And he said at the height of traffic, they'd have six planes that were parked in Bismarck overnight but only four gates. So it means a lot of congestion at that point.
Okay. Any of these expansion talks, new routes or even partnerships with different airlines?
It sounds
like it's all physical.
If they can expand the airport, that will be an incentive for more carriers to come in or for the existing carriers to come in with larger planes. We're already starting to see a move toward that as we're seeing less of the 50-passenger regional jets, more of the 76 and maybe up to the 90s.
One more story for this week. It is near the end of World Breastfeeding Week, which fits into World Breastfeeding Month. This mm-hmm. can often be quite an issue for mothers to find a place where they feel welcome to do that.
It can be. And the State Health Department and local health agencies are urging businesses to make accommodations so women can breastfeed their children. As a matter of fact, there are programs where they have champions of breastfeeding, where a business will be, you know, identified as friendly to young mothers.
Is there anything, any consideration for making it more similar to something like the American with Disabilities Act, where it has to be, like it's a law?
Yeah, that has not gotten there yet, but I do know that there is talk about that.
Okay. We check in with News Director Dave Thompson once a week. Dave, as always, we appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Ashley.
Natural North Dakota is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Otto Bremmer Trust, investing in people, places, and opportunities in North Dakota, Montana, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Learn more at ottobremmer.org.
On the next Radio Lab.
Hail, brimstone, endless rain. I mean, a kind of crazy time, really.
You hear this duet from down there, live clarinet and wail.
You know, we live in a world of cycles on cycles.
If you want to go 1,000 miles an hour in the opposite direction, you will stop the day.
Superman did that once, I think, when he had this thing with Lois.
Superman would have so messed up everybody on Earth.
A sideways glance at our bizarre planet.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and biologist Chuck Lura takes inspiration from the natural world and also sometimes from books. He talks about the combination of those two in this week's Natural North Dakota essay, Morning Doves.
I've been reading Theodore Roosevelt's Ranch Life and the Hunting Trail. It's an interesting read about life in the North Dakota Badlands in the 1880s. In Chapter 3, The Home Ranch, Roosevelt describes the quiet surrounding the ranch, and I quote, "There are few sounds to break the stillness. From the upper branches of the cottonwood trees overhead, whose shimmering, tremulous leaves are hardly ever quiet, but if the wind stirs at all, rustle and quiver and sigh all day long, comes every now and then the soft, melancholy cooing of the mourning dove, whose voice always seems far away and expresses more than any other sound in nature the sadness of gentle, hopeless, never-ending grief." Unquote. Most everyone's familiar with mourning doves. They're permanent residents over much of the United States, but here in North Dakota, as well as a few other northern states and Canada, they're summer residents. They can produce up to 6 broods of 1 to 3 young a year, perhaps 2 of which are produced during the summer months here in North Dakota. About half of their nests are rather crude and constructed in trees. The other half is constructed on the ground. I suspect that a few among us don't realize that these doves are not doves of the morning, as in the time of day, but rather like mourning, mourning doves. Their call, as Roosevelt notes, really does sound like they are in a state of mourning. But it might surprise you to learn that biologists have discovered that most of these common calls are sung by single males. Apparently, they need to find a mate. It should be easy to hear the call of the mourning dove this summer if one just takes the time. So consider getting out and making a point of really listening to their call. It's one of the more interesting sounds of North Dakota summers. You might even start to imagine what it would have been like to sit along the Little Missouri River in the 1880s, and hear the mournful call of the mourning dove. And if you're looking for some interesting reading, consider Roosevelt's Ranch Life and the Hunting Trail. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 5th.
down-to-earth people know that manure is a fact of life for farmers and ranchers. Cattle, horses, sheep, swine, ducks, turkeys, and chickens all produce manure, which can be used as fertilizer to enrich fields and pasture lands. The worth of manure as fertilizer has always been appreciated, but stepping into a fresh cow pie or horse apple was to be avoided. Sometimes it could look dry, only to send a person sliding. The key to successfully navigating through a cow yard, horse pasture, or barnyard involved keeping your eyes open and wearing the right kind of footwear. Barnyard shoes are elemental for those with livestock. On this date in 1920, a newspaper advertisement touted the virtues of Huskamp's barnyard shoe and Huskamp's barnyard shoe oil. These work shoes, according to a 1913 advertisement in Valley City, were manure-proof and ammonia-proof, guaranteed not to rot or crack through from barnyard service. These Iowa-made work boots were said to resist manure acids and barnyard liquids that could crack and destroy ordinary shoes. Some North Dakotans wore Huskamp's boots, while others, in the years after 1912, bought Minnesota-made Red Wing shoes. The company's chief line was commonly known as the Farmer's Shoe. They were manure-proof, stone-proof, and as near waterproof as leather can be, to quote them. Another option for counteracting mud and manure in the country was the simple expedient of wearing rubber overshoes. As decades passed, North Dakota farmers and ranchers opted for what are known as manure boots, knee-high rubber boots that have proven to be liquid-proof. Other names for this type of footwear include chore boots, muck boots, or barn boots. Some of these manure boots have reinforced steel toes, others do not. Whatever type of barnyard shoe or boot was used, they could bring a big mess into the house and needed to be left on the porch, or, in more modern times, a designated mudroom. Such mudrooms became a design feature in the 1950s, even for urbanites and suburbanites, so folks could clean up before coming in to eat. So the concluding message for this day is simply this: watch your step and don't put your foot in it, or maybe buy some manure boots. Today's Dakota Date Book, written by Professor Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Date Book is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Thanks so much for listening.